That's about prayer. Our Father, we bring our thanks to Thee for the ties that bind us in the fellowship of Christ. Give to us the openness of spirit and the alertness of mind to be taught and challenged by those who bring a prophetic word to us. And give us the courage to respond in the Spirit of Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen. The spring lectures consist of two lectures given each spring here at the seminary. It's an honor to present our lecturer for the current series. Dr. Michael Novak, who's currently a lecturer with the University Speakers Bureau, and he is speaking on college, university, and graduate school campuses across the nation. Dr. Novak is a native of Pennsylvania. He holds degrees from Stonehill College in Massachusetts, from Gregorian University in Rome, Italy, and from Harvard University. He has studied at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., has been a teaching fellow at Harvard. He's taught at Stanford University, at Union Theological Seminary in New York, at the State University of New York, Old Westbury, at Carleton College, at Immaculate Heart College in California, and at the University of California in Santa Barbara. In 1971, he was a speech writer for Senator Edmund Muskie. In July and August 1972, he was a staff member for Senator McGovern's presidential campaign. And from August to November 1972, he was the senior speechwriter for Sergeant Shriver, a Democratic candidate for vice president. He has worked on the editorial staffs of the Christian Century, Commonweal, Motive, Journal of Religious of Ecumenical Studies, Christianity in Crisis, and Worldview. Dr. Novak is the author of 15 books, has contributed chapters to at least 10 other books, and has had many articles published in numerous journals, including many learned journals. And at this point, I must simply record my frustration that I am unable even to mention many significant contributions that he has made in his relatively brief but truly remarkable career. I must take time to say that he is married to the former Karen Ruth Loeb of Cresco, Iowa, who is a professional artist, and he and Mrs. Novak have 3 children. I've been asked to remind all concerned that Dr. Novak will be a guest of the faculty today at a luncheon at the seminary cafeteria at 12:30, and also that between 2 and 3 o'clock this afternoon, he will have an informal conference with students in the Commons Room, not as previously announced in the conference room at Mackey Hall, Commons Room, not the conference room. Dr. Novak is a very important Christian thinker, a gifted teacher, speaker, and journalist. We are pleased and honored that he was able to accept our invitation to bring these lectures to us. The theme of Dr. Novak's lectures is Theology of Radical Politics. It is a pleasure for me to present Dr. Novak to you.
I'm very happy for the chance to be with you for the 2-day period, and I look forward very much to the opportunity for question and discussion later during the day. That's the period when I most benefit by the chance to be somewhere else. And I'm only sorry that even immediately after this lecture, there isn't an opportunity to have questions and discussion. I'd like to make a point of clarification by way of beginning. When I use the word radical in the title, I don't have in mind what one English writer observing the American scene has called radical smug. That is the sense that has grown up among a great many people who think of themselves as radical in the United States, of a superior morality, the sense of having a greater insight and of being more conscientious people than anybody else in the country. And I don't have in mind the use of the word as associated with radical chic. That is to say, related to that class of Americans, which is, after all, the wealthiest left in the world, the richest left in the history of the planet. The meaning of the word radical as the meaning of the word left over the last 10 years has come increasingly to be identified with people who are among the most powerful and the most wealthy in the nation. Only about 10% of the American population has a college degree. Only about 10% of the American population earns over $17,000 a year, even when husband and wife both work. A little less than 10% of the American population holds a professional job as a journalist, professor, doctor, lawyer, consultant, and so forth, where you're not paid by the hour. You're paid by the month or by the year, and where your time, therefore, is your own. What you do with several days out of a week or out of a month is up to you, and where, therefore, you have a lot of opportunity for political activism. So I'm not talking about a radical politics, which is the politics of the left wing of this top 10% of the population. I'm not talking about Michael Harrington's constituency of conscience. I'm not talking about the university radicals or the radicals of journalism. There was a strike at the Washington Post last fall. The reporters and editors were joining the time-honored tradition of working people by carrying on a strike for a minimum wage of $24,000 a year, which isn't bad. It puts them in the top 5% of the population by income. But that tends to be a journalist's view of the middle class. They think of themselves as middle class, $24,000 a year, and that's what the lowest paid are to get. And thinking they're just like everybody else, like the electricians and the TV repairmen and the people who sell them automobiles and so forth, without any comprehension of the fact that they're standing in the top 5% of the population. So when I use the word radical, I don't use it in those two senses. I'm thinking of an older use of the word radical, and indeed an older use of the word left, in which to be on the left means to be on the side of working people, to be on the side of people who work in the mines and the mills and the fields, and people who work in all those, we sometimes call them white-collar jobs, which are really blue-collar jobs. People who work in the post office and the bus company. People who work as janitors, as security guards. People who do all those jobs that lie below the professional level, that lie below the college level, that lie well below the income level of $17,000 a year, 90% of the population. To side with people of that sort, of that class, used to be what was meant by being on the left. And that's the sense of the word in which I still intend the meaning of the word radical. It means thinking through politics and every issue in politics from the point of view of what it does to working people. And secondly, I mean the word radical in a sense in which you begin to think about the roots of your own politics, and indeed of a politics that would be serviceable in a nation like our own, or in a world like that in which we live. I like to quote a sentence of Charles Peguy, the French writer and thinker, who once said, "Politics begins in mysticism, and mysticism always ends in politics." And he went on to say that people often think that politics is the realistic side of the equation, and mysticism is simply the romance. What really counts, what's really solid, is what is done in politics. And what is nice but ineffectual is done on the side of mysticism. And he said it's exactly the reverse that's true. That whatever energies of life there are, whatever energies of idea and of passion that there are, whatever energies there are for creativity, arise out of mysticism. What he's thinking of is, the French word is mystique. And that only when these energies of life become codified and institutionalized and hardened do we have politics. And so politics is the solidification, if you want. It's the expression in society of the energies of life. And no sooner is it expressed than it starts to harden and becomes in its own way a form of death. And one has to look elsewhere for fresh energies to keep enlivening the institution. Well, sometimes things are like that in the church. I know a friend of mine, John Cogley, says that religion is rather like a sense of music. You either have it or you don't. And most of those who don't join religious organizations. What he means is that people are terrified of a God they cannot see, or touch, or taste, or feel, or get their hands on. Terrified as well of the judgments and demands of such a God, which are very hard to get one's hands on as well. It's hard to be clear about. And terrified about the emptiness in which they live, which is as keen as the emptiness of any atheist or any agnostic. And so being afraid of the invisible God, they find it infinitely easier to put up buildings and to have fund drives and to recruit members and so forth. All those things you can busy yourself in and call it religion as a way of avoiding religion. I'm not sure what the Southern Baptist equivalent would be, but among Roman Catholics, there is a commandment which is designed to fill such necessities. It goes like this: when in doubt, build. In any case, I'd like to talk a little bit about today about the meaning of this mysticism, and tomorrow more about the meaning of the politics. To get at this word mysticism, I'd like to approach in this way. We often use the word myth when we mean the silly things, the silly point of view, the unrealistic point of view that people elsewhere have, particularly people of long ago. And correspondingly, I'd suggest that we supply everywhere we see the word myth the phrase sense of reality, so that we might include ourselves. When we speak of others, we say myth. We mean what they take to be real, what they take to be important, what they take to be significant. Of course, we know that they're wrong, and that's why we call it myth. But if we ask ourselves what is our myth, and supply the words, what is our sense of reality, we get a much clearer sense of what that word intends. If you can't uncover for yourself, one by one I mean, individually, and indeed as a group, what it is we take to be most significant in our lives, what it is in fact we take to be most significant, not what we say, but what we do and what we feel, what we take to be most meaningful, what we take to be a kind of guarantee that we have our feet on the ground, that we're in touch with reality, that what we're doing is true. If you can uncover that for yourself, and it's not so easy, because most of us have read dozens and dozens of books, scores of books, hundreds of books, we have more theories than we have experiences. And it's not easy to uncover what it is that we actually hold, what it is that we have actually experienced, what it is that we ourselves, one by one, are sure of. I know many students who get terribly upset because of what they've read. They haven't had an identity crisis. They think something's wrong with them because it says they should at a certain age. And so it is with hundreds of things. We read books with theories about what we ought to be feeling and thinking before we've even been feeling and thinking. And so it isn't as easy as it seems to uncover what is your sense of reality. It's extremely difficult. St. Augustine used to say that he had his keenest experience of God, of the infinity of God, when he walked on the beaches of the Mediterranean and saw the innumerable stars. Well, when I walk on the beaches of Long Island where I live, we don't see any stars. This sort of smog and light. But the comparable sense of infinity you receive when you walk into a university bookstore and you cannot possibly even read all the books in your own field, let alone all those in related fields, let alone all those that would instruct you somewhat about the life we're living from fields that are of interest, even though they're not of professional interest. There's no way one can read all that. And so one gets here the sense of infinity. The point I'm trying to make is that much more than we realize, we live in what the Buddha instructed his disciples in the world of Maya, the world of illusion. It's exceedingly difficult to know what is real, what is firm in one's own life, in the life of the nation. Is it true, for example, that the United States, to speak of the larger body first, is at the weakest moment of its history? Is it true that now is the time for our adversaries in the world to strike hardest against us because we have been so injured by Vietnam? We are so ashamed of the betrayal of our allies and so hurt by an intervention that didn't work, which was a colossal failure. That our leadership, the leadership of public opinion in the Congress and in the press and everywhere, is urging upon us withdrawal everywhere. Portugal has suddenly gone in a communist direction. It is conceivable, even likely, that Spain will do as well on the death of Franco. It is likely that Turkey will pull out of NATO. Already in 1973, no nation in Europe save one would allow American aircraft on their way to Israel to stop or even to fly over their territory. Those very nations of Europe that created Israel. And Portugal was the only nation that allowed our aircraft to stop. Portugal won't do that again. Almost anywhere in the world, on one view, that you look, the United States is in the weakest position it has been in for 30 or 40 years. The Arab nations have the wherewithal and the power to bring about the economic collapse of Italy, of Japan, of India, of Great Britain, of France, perhaps even of Germany, at almost any time they choose. And it is imaginable that within the period of the next 10 years, the United States would remain the only democracy on the earth, still economically creative, still economically able to exist without a change in its form of government. In other words, that those descriptions which people in the 1930s used to use about the crisis of Western civilization are far more true now in the 1970s than they were in the 1930s. Is all that true? Or is that just a mirage? Just an image far away from the realities. And the realities are, by contrast, that the United States, having cut off commitments which it could not keep, in which its interests, its real interests, were not involved in, has now pruned the tree, as it were. And having been chastened, is less likely to be involved in foolish ventures in the future, having learned that it is not infinite. And that the United States is therefore in a stronger position than ever before. Well, which is true? It makes a tremendous difference which one is true. And yet, in trying to answer such a problem, it's like fighting through clouds. It's hard to know the truth. Were we right to go into Vietnam? What if 20 years from now we discover in the documents of China, of North Vietnam, even of Russia, of guerrillas in Malaysia and all over, that only the intervention of the United States in Vietnam prevented them from carrying out courses of action which they had planned and already had in force, and which they abandoned because of our intervention. So that our intervention there had enormously important effects, maybe even on the side of defending India. That is, maybe there really was the beginnings of Chinese pressure upon India, an attempt to collapse the government of India, and so forth. And therefore, maybe the intervention in Vietnam, which now looks so foolish and so stupid, was one of the most important and courageous and unselfish and indeed productive deeds that the United States ever did. It wouldn't be the first time in history that all those who tried to interpret an event within the generation of the event were completely wrong. If you look at the history of what the intellectual class in the United States did in the First World War, at first opposing the war from a kind of pacifism, and then flip-flopping almost overnight and becoming the most ardent defenders of the war and providing the grist, the ideas, and the structure for the expansion of American power in the years after the war, and then going through the same path in the 1930s, when every campus in this country, or many major campuses in this country, were the scene of enormous peace marches. Everybody was for peace. Candlelight vigils for peace. We'll never fight. Young people were saying by the thousands. And then almost overnight came the commitment of those same campuses to the war effort. You learn, in a way, not ever to trust the deliverances of intellectuals, the most respected writers, the most respected organs, as a set of interpretations about what is happening at a given time. So often, the most intelligent, the most respected, are wrong. So often, the true meaning of events is exactly the reverse of the meaning which is dominant in the culture. So often, some ironic little turn, which was missed by almost everybody, was the most significant event. And the superficial, or not superficial, the dominant course of events turned out to be insignificant. What I'm trying to suggest is that if we think of Peggy's sentence, politics begins in mysticism, and mysticism always ends in politics, it's important to see how difficult it is to get one's mysticism straight, if you will, to get one's sense of reality straight. It's very hard to know what is real, what is true in a nation, in the relationship of a nation with other nations, about the direction of history, the important movements at a given time. We are indeed operating often in a kingdom of illusion, in a cloud of Maya. And very much of politics indeed is based upon illusion. You go on a campaign and you may make 15 or 16 appearances in a given day. And it may indeed have taken the staff weeks of work to prepare that day and its events, and to identify the people. Let's say you're going into Detroit, to find the street and the families in Detroit that you want to visit. You may only be there for 20 minutes in a living room, or in a meeting hall, or on the street. But to find which ones has taken somebody a lot of time and effort, getting people out of work so they can be there and so on. Setting up the subject so that the minutes you're there, what you talk about is very well defined. Well, you may go through 15 or 16 such meetings in a day. And then at the end of the day, you watch the television, which tells the world what you did that day in 1 minute or two. And you've been going since 7 in the morning to 11 at night. And then you watch on television what television presents as the reality. And it's absolutely staggering, because you may not recognize at all what television has on. What they filmed was so insignificant, nobody on the staff even noticed it. Yet for all your friends in the city, all those who watch on television, that's your day. That's the reality now. Whatever was on television, that's real for most people. What you actually did for the day is unreal. Nobody knows about that. It has no social meaning. And the same thing is true in the newspapers when you read the newspaper account of what you did during the day. So the more informed people are, the better informed they are, in an odd way, the farther out of touch with reality they may be. Those who would count on watching all the television they can, reading all the journals and all the newspapers that they can, may be even more removed from the reality of what happened from those who don't care and operate by common sense. I'm not asserting that, I'm saying maybe. The point I'm trying to make is that even in a civilization which prides itself on its communications, prides itself on its realism, prides itself on the importance of being a well-informed citizen and so forth, even in such a civilization, it is astonishing to note the absolutely massive illusions, the fogs of perception and trying to cut through them to what really happened, what somebody is really like, what the events really were, is even more difficult than form criticism of the Bible. Now, it's also true in our personal lives as in our public and social lives. A great many persons experience what I would refer to as the experience of nothingness. Now, it's not the words that are significant. This experience, I would like to stress, is an experience. It doesn't matter what words you call it by. If there are words that are more telling, or a word that is more telling for you than nothingness, by all means use it. I'm not asking you in the next few moments to pay attention to words, but rather to concentrate on an experience which I'm confident that a great many of you have shared, and even more confident that a great many of you, or all of you, indeed, will share. It's an experience which has been known at all times in human history and in every culture. But it's an experience which comes very early and very vividly in our culture with great frequency. It was one thing when Nietzsche, about a century ago, in his 50s, threw up his hands in exclamation after long and arduous investigations and discovered the tissue, the very weak tissue on which the intellectual life in which he had been instructed was standing, and broke through it and perceived the abyss, and in throwing up his hands called his discovery a joyous wisdom. It's very different when one has gone through all one's life, through many hard inquiries, and at a ripe period discovered the meaninglessness of what one was doing and of life itself. And it's a very different thing to be 13 years old and already to know that, already to have breathed that air, already ready to have had that insight. And it's this rather more common experience that we find present in the United States and indeed in other places at the present time. Let me describe the experience indirectly for a moment. Imagine that you are looking out a window on an autumn day, late in the afternoon, thinking nothing in particular, from a second or third floor, and barely hearing the noises from outside, almost being present to what's outside the window and not being present to it. And of a sudden, seeing very clearly the story you have been living out with your own life, seeing, as it were, the outlines of what you have been encouraging in yourself, trying to promote in yourself, fighting for in yourself, and those things you've been trying to inhibit in yourself, to remove from yourself, to extricate from yourself. And you suddenly have the image that you've been doing things exactly backwards. That all those things you've been trying to encourage in yourself, you should be inhibiting. And all those things you have been trying to inhibit in yourself, on those you should be just letting go. And you see others around you who are doing that. You catch an image of the way you have been living the story you've been trying to live out. Not just the direction you've been trying to go in, but the style with which you do it. Hesitant and slow and modest, or aggressive and self-confident, whatever. And seeing that story, you hate it. And you imagine an alternative. And imagine yourself living in a different story. Living as a quite different person. The same, but different. And then yet a third. And a fourth. And the perception comes through that there's absolutely nothing in the world that insists that you must live the way you are living. And there is nothing that makes necessary any one of these other forms of life. That the choice among these ways of life is exceedingly, what shall I say, unnecessitated, arbitrary. Now, the first person to write about nihilism, when the Europeans take up anything, they always make an ism of it. Though in writing about nihilism, one is also talking about some common human experiences. When you write as a European, you do it as a theory. And when you write as an American, you try to do it in terms of the experience. In any case, it was in 1832, an obscure doctor. But already by the 1850s, Turgenev and Dostoevsky, in different ways, were trying to describe the growth of this experience in themselves and among others in Eastern Europe. And Nietzsche and Freud in Western Europe a little bit later were again noticing the frequency of this experience in themselves and in others. And in the 20th century, it became rather a staple of discussion and of introspection in Europe. Less so for a long time in America, where we live in a culture, the only one in the world, with a constitutional obligation that we all be happy, where it's extremely important to be committed to progress, which is our most important product, and to imagine that the future will be better than the present. Exceedingly important psychologically to Americans. To imagine that tomorrow can be better, that this is a new world as opposed to an old world, that there is here a new beginning and always new beginnings, and that we can shape the future. You can demoralize Americans by suggesting that there's no point to what they're doing. People will say, well, then what's the use? If we can't make the future any better, then what's the use? What's the point? Because for Americans, for most Americans, the whole point of action is shaping the future. And if you suggest to them that the future is exactly like the present, displaced a little bit, rearranged a little bit, but going nowhere in a series of endless cycles, it becomes for many a matter of great despair. Not for all, but for many. You remember the little signs on the bumper stickers that say, America, love it or leave it. Well, you can imagine all over Europe 100 years ago, on the side of barns and on the back of ox carts and so forth, little signs which said, Europe, love it or leave it. And most of our ancestors did. And yet there was built into the American understanding of this event the notion that the best left Europe, the most creative, the most adventurous, right? the bold pioneers. What if it was the other way around? What if the ones who left Europe were the lazy, the shiftless, the ones who couldn't make it, the misfits, the no goods? Anybody who can make it was doing all right. Why would they leave? And that all, as the newspapers of the time in the United States used to picture it, all the scum of Europe came here. Then you would see, I think, some of the emotional necessity for Americans to think that they are good. President Nixon used to say often in his most sincere voice, I know America, and the heart of Americans is good. And the Congress would cheer and yell. He did it twice at a State of the Union message and had a 1 minute standing ovation, whistling, banging on tabletops. Both times he did it. I know America, and the heart of America, of Americans, is good. But what if it isn't? What if the heart of Americans is just as crummy and confused and mixed up as all other human hearts? Generous and greedy, avaricious and compassionate, humble and arrogant, cruel and kind, just as ambivalent and so forth as every other human heart. Well, it's exceedingly important for Americans somehow not to face that and to think that America is peculiarly a good place, peculiarly a moral territory, a new world, a new paradise, a new Eden. That means not corrupt like all those foreigners. It means not all mixed up like Constantinople. I don't know if you watch Kojak on television, but it's the first time we've ever had a Southern European sensibility and perspective in a detective show, where Kojak knows every night you've got to stop a rapist, a muggist, a murderer tonight. But they'll be back tomorrow. You're not stopping murder. You're not stopping rape. You're not stopping muggery. You're stopping one. And there are thousands of them out there. In Manhattan, it's so bad they go in twos. But there are thousands of them out there. And Kojak is essentially saying, I think, very different from any other detective show, it's all right. It was like this in Athens. It was like this in Constantinople. Enjoy yourself. We got a job to do tonight. We do it. We have some drinks. We see a good part of the city. The sense of combating evil is the reverse of the American one. The American one is to root out evil. The white hats should win. In Kojak, there's no sense of that at all. Evil is so pervasive, so omnipresent. You do your job. Do it in the most dignified, honorable way you can, but don't dream for a minute that you're going to root out evil. No possibility of that. And that's fine. It's like my grandmother who came from Eastern Europe, from Czechoslovakia, from Slovakia, about 80 years ago. If she would have ever heard Professor Paul Ehrlich, a colleague of mine at Stanford, speak about the population explosion and the fact that we only have, I think it's 5 years of ozone left because of all the spray cans, and only about 25 years for the atmosphere as a whole before we use it up, and the waters of all the streams are going to be brackened within 30 years if we continue, and on top of that we're most likely to die the most horrible death of all, which would be to be up to our armpits, you know, squishing in babies through the population explosion. Which you fly over from New York, you know, down to here, and you don't see, I mean, for miles and miles and miles and miles, there isn't a human being, and then you come upon a clunk. It just seems like such an empty continent, all told. But anyway, had my grandmother heard how horrible the end of the world coming soon is going to be, I know exactly what she would have said. Yeah. She knew it was going to end. She didn't know when. It was going to have a bad ending. No doubt about that. You can't come from Eastern Europe and not know that the world is in for a bad ending. When? One doesn't know. Could be any day. Could be any day. She never believed a word about human progress. She always thought, whatever they give you with one hand, they take away in the other. My mother, I remember, I was very little, but after World War II, the A&Ps and other stores began bringing you tomatoes and other vegetables wrapped in cellophane. That was nice. They weren't so bruised. And secondly, they had invented these new things so they didn't have any diseases now. When you got your tomato home, you hardly ever had rot on the inside, as you used to always have in a certain percentage of cases. And my mother thought that was so terrific. And my grandmother thought it was fine, except they didn't taste like tomatoes anymore. Well, what I'm trying to suggest is that all through our public and our private and our personal life, there's this very deep sense of not knowing what is illusion or what is not. And specifically, that in the United States, that sense of being part of human progress, that almost everything we did, especially as educated people, especially as scientists or as engineers, that almost everything we did was an almost priestly act. It brought about the betterment of the human race. So that our every deed, our every preparation was almost holy, almost religious. That sense is not trustworthy. It may be that all the things we have been calling progress and advance are in fact precipitating not only the nation but the whole planet toward destruction. So that what looks as though it's an upturn is in fact a rapidly accelerating downward slope. I'm not asserting that that's true. I'm saying that in millions of hearts, people have lost faith in what they themselves are doing, not what the world is doing. Everywhere you go, you find professors who no longer like teaching, who are no longer certain it's a good thing to be doing, who no longer can persuade themselves that what they're doing has genuine human value, who feel as cheated as the fellow working in the factory, where the average wage for a factory earner is $8,600. All through American life, not at the weak places, but at the strong places, right where people are at their strongest and at their best, there is very often a deep sense of doubt about the value, the meaning, the significance of what the person is doing. Is it worth doing? A student of mine at Stanford, a brilliant young girl, as a junior, I can't tell the whole story, but as a junior, she began to show that very first symptom of the experience of nothingness, at least among undergraduates. You're too mature for this. She began to sleep a great deal. That is, there just wasn't any point in getting up or doing anything. She couldn't bring herself to do it. And she wrote home to her mother trying to explain why she no longer wanted to finish her pre-med degree. Though she was doing very well on it, it seems that when she was very little, she must have repaired the wing of a bird or something. And her grandmother said, Susie's going to be the doctor in the family. There'd never been a doctor in the family. And she was good in math and in all the sciences and so forth and doing very well. And so she was at Stanford in pre-med, and all of a sudden it hits her. Why do I want to be a doctor? But if she didn't want to be a doctor, she didn't know anything else she wanted to be either. And she'd spent some time in Germany at the Stanford campus there and got a terrible feeling about the denials of people that she lived with about the Nazi period. You have to understand, they say, we knew nothing about this, but right down the street is the concentration camp, the remains of it. three or four blocks. And it was very like the Vietnam War in her eyes. She was seeing it differently from Germany, and she was imagining people saying to her, or she saying to her children later, "But we didn't understand, we didn't know." In any case, she wrote home to her mother trying to explain all these feelings. She had always been able to talk to her mother. And she got back a letter from her mother. Now, do you imagine that her mother wrote back to her and said, "Dearest darling, don't worry, it's only the ontological anxiety that all of us must share." No. If you're an American, you're not entitled to have an ontological anxiety. If you've been fed as well as you have been and brought up in as good circumstances as you are and have the privilege of going to a great campus like Stanford, you don't have any right not to be happy. You have to be happy. So her mother wrote back to her what all good mothers would write, what your mother and mine would write. "Darling, are you sure you're eating well? Are you getting enough sleep? Among us, an existential anxiety is to be counterattacked by food or sleep or vitamins. And you get enough of those, what more could you want? What more could you ask? What right do you have to be anxious or uncertain? We know we live in a good world. We know we live in a good country. We know we're contributing to the benefit of the human race. What else do you need? Get your wits about you as soon as you can and pool your share. Don't badmouth. See the bright side of things and contribute. Don't be gloomy and pessimistic. See the possibilities and grab them, make something of them. Be up and doing. Like my father-in-law says, he's a lawyer in Iowa, in a little town called the Friendly City, which interests me because the town I come from in Pennsylvania is also called the Friendly City. I think there must be 10,000 friendly cities in the United States. Nobody knows what a friendly people we are everywhere. If they only knew us one by one, they'd see how good we are. Good neighbors, good folks. I like the people here. People always tell you wherever you go. They're nice people. In any case, my father-in-law, we tried to get him to go with us to a film one day, a European film, probably a Bergman film, and he wouldn't go, absolutely refused. And he said, "Oh, I don't want to go to something like that." He said, "They're so gloomy, and they're so pessimistic, and so unreal. Besides," he said, after going through that all day long at the office, he said, "I want to be entertained at night." So how could you ever explain to him what he said? It's so unreal. After going through that all day long at the office. He knows that's the way the world is. But the way you cope with it is by not facing it. What I'm trying to say is there's enormous policy of cover-up in our lives. Forgetfulness. Now one last anecdote to bring home the kind of experience that I want. Supposing your son, 3 years old, is crying out in a fever. And you go into him at 3 or 4 in the morning. He's calling out your name. And then tossing and turning and tangled up on the sheets, and the sheets are soaking wet. And he's really having a fevered dream and doesn't know where he is. And you pick him up and you say, "Richie, it's all right. It's Daddy." And you turn on the light and you tap on the dresser. And say, "Here you are, this is your dresser. Here's your teddy bear." And he's still panicky. "Here's the window and the curtains, here's your bed. It's all right, Richie. Everything's okay." And then it suddenly hits you. What if you're telling a lie? Everything's all right. What if what he's going through in his dream is much more like reality? And then what you're trying to do, here's your teddy bear, here's the dresser, here's the window, here's your daddy. That's not reality at all. My point is that a great many people in the United States, and I'm sure many of you, have found perceptions of this sort coming much more frequently. There is a widespread experience of nothingness. What does nihilism mean? Nietzsche asks in probably the most concentrated writing on the subject, in The Will to Power, first 30 or 40 pages. The question why has no answer. We can't act, he says, unless we have a future, a purpose, unless we're connected to the future and connected to those around us, unless there's a kind of unity between us and the future and us and our surroundings, a kind of coherence. We can't act. And so, in order to act, we invent a meaning. We invent a unity. We give ourselves a purpose. As a society and as individuals. And that purpose, that unity, that meaning which we put into the world, the chaos of the world, we can also pull out. And when it's pulled out, why has no answer? And the experience of nothingness arises. When the experience of nothingness arises, it is an opportunity for a very creative period or a very destructive period. But it is at the root of an important political period. And that's what I'd like to talk about tomorrow.